reality of time and the evolution of laws of nature, and he doesn't really need an introduction.
Thank you, Hans. I just, I would like to start by thanking the organizers for the invitation of this talk and for the meeting, which has been a very, very good meeting for me, a very stimulating, inspiring meeting. And one aspect of the meeting, which I think has been marvelous, is the mixing of people from different fields, from philosophy, from mathematics, from physics and cosmology, and the intermingling of the approaches. So this is a meeting in which several philosophers have presented physical models and mathematical models to be studied as physicists. And that was very stimulating. But now you have the flip side of that, which I apologize for in advance, which is a physicist attempting to make a philosophical argument. So I ask your forbearance. And I also ask the forbearance of some people here have heard this talk or versions of this talk before over the last year and a half or so. Now, this is, as I said, an attempt to make a philosophical argument about the issue of the reality of time, the issue of the present moment, which Raphael introduced very well in his first talk this morning, and related issues. One issue which is lurking always in the background is Platonism, and in physics, Platonism in mathematics, and the role of mathematics in physics. This work evolved out of an idea about cosmology that I chanced into about 18 years ago, which figures as the background of the talk, which I'll be mentioning briefly later in the talk, which was a notion that to explain the parameters in the Standard Model of Particle Physics in a way that was genuinely offered genuine explanation and made genuinely falsifiable predictions, it was necessary to consider that laws of nature may have evolved, much like Neil and Roger talked about. There may have been universes before our Big Bang, and if that's so, as they mentioned, it might have been that the laws of nature were different in previous universes. And so the notion of laws evolving and the claim that making laws evolve makes physics and cosmology more rather than less testable, confirmable or disconfirmable, is the main claim that underlies this talk. The issue of time is relevant because, as somebody who works mostly in quantum gravity, I've mostly taken for granted, or at least initially took for granted, the correctness of arguments like Julian Barber has made, I think, the strongest, and other people in the meeting alluded to, that that time is not fundamentally part of the laws of physics, but is emergent. And there's an obvious conflict between believing that laws have evolved in time in the past, so that in some sense time is a more reliable or more stable attribute of nature than what the laws happen to be at the moment, and the notion that time is emergent from a set of laws. And it was that contradiction that, after many years, led me back into thinking about these issues of the evolution of laws and what that implies for the notion of time. Now, I have a collaborator in this work, Roberto Mangibera Unger, who is a philosopher not well known in philosophy of science circles, but extremely well known in philosophy of social theory, law, and politics. And I'll indicate, sort of as I go on, how Roberto's thinking has come into this. But just briefly to say that Roberto is the provocateur in this collaboration, and my role has mostly been to catch up, which is thinking. Now, Roberto is in a line of thought that, loosely speaking, is called American pragmatism. And there is the remarkable thinking of Charles Sanders Peirce about the evolution of laws, and I won't read all of this, but the first and last lines are very pertinent to the discussions of this meeting. To suppose universal laws of nature capable of being apprehended and yet having no reason for their specific forms, but standing inexplicable and irrational, is hardly a justifiable position. So he raises the issue of why these laws rather than other laws of nature, and he concludes by saying the only possible way of accounting for the laws of nature and for uniformity in general is to suppose them results of evolution. And that's, again, the key claim that this work revolves around, that making laws changeable and subject to evolution is more explanatory than the standard notion that laws are timeless. Now, here is my collaborator, Roberto Unger, in 1987 in a book on social theory where he drew analogy to cosmology. And again, you can read the whole thing yourself faster than I can read it to you. But he starts by saying you can trace properties of the present universe back to the properties it must have had at the beginning, but you cannot show that these are the only properties that the universe might have had. Only a relative, I'm jumping, but you can read in, only a relative distinction exists between law-like explanation and narration of a one-time historical sequence. Well, that's a provocative blow, if you take it seriously, to our usual notion of law in physics, in which there's an absolute distinction between law-like explanation and narration of a one-time historical sequence. And part of my burden is to make that not crazy to you. And indeed, he attacks people like ourselves who believe there is such a distinction by saying that people who appeal to fixed conceptions of necessity, contingency, and possibility are simply confused. So that's the provocation, and my task is to flesh out the provocation, which is the journey, you know, in some sense, to take you on the journey that I have come on. To take this kind of provocation seriously. And by the way, it's interesting that that was written before the notion of many universes and the landscape of theories and evolution of laws on universes was a common topic among physicists and cosmologists. So it was a kind of anticipation, but within the tradition of American pragmatism, not at all an anticipation just to carry on from Peirce. Okay, so here is the start of a philosophical argument, and I'm going to start with an assertion in red that everything that we observe or experience as human beings is observed or experienced in a moment of time, which is one of a succession of such moments. And I'm going to take that as just true. If somebody wants to argue about that, we can do it at the pub night tonight over wine and beer. And for reference, we'll call that the experience of the succession of present moments. The argument starts by pointing out that either nature is so organized, that is, as a succession of moments, or nature is not so organized. Let's take the common view, which is among physicists, which is that it's not actually so organized. Okay. Then our experience and observation of the world as ordered in a succession of moments is an emergent property, not a fundamental property of nature. And if that's the case, then there must be, first of all, a description of the world in which the flow of present moments plays no role, and people have argued that that description of the world is inherent in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, for example, the fundamental equation of quantum cosmology. And there must be an explanation, however, of why all the experiences and observations that we as observers, intelligent beings, whatever, in the world have why all our experiences and observations are so ordered. Okay, now, this view has been popular among some philosophers. There's a quotation from J.C.C. Smart. Our notion of time is flowing. The transitory aspects of time is an illusion which prevents us from seeing the world as it really is. So that's a point of view that has much support. On the other hand, let's consider the possibility that nature is so organized and we experience the world as a succession of moments because that's the way nature is organized. And we'll call that assertion the reality of the succession of present moments, sometimes RSPM. That implies that anything that is real or true about the world is real or true in a moment, which is one of a succession of moments. And that's a version of what philosophers sometimes call presentism. It's the commitment that reality and truth are attributes in a moment of time. And that is a view that also has a history in philosophy. And there's an unlikely quote from Kurt Gödel, who I wouldn't have thought held this view, asserting that the existence of an objective lapse of time means, or at least is equivalent to, the fact that reality consists of an infinity of layers of now which come into existence successively. Okay. Myself, as I said, I've come full circle on this view. Now, I think there are several distinct arguments for believing in the reality of time, or particularly in the form of the reality of the succession of present moments, from different domains of science, as well as, of course, philosophical arguments. In this talk, I'm going to concentrate on arguments from cosmology. Okay, so this is part, these are part of a longer argument that I'll allude to some of the other branches of the argument, but this is part of an argument. Okay, now, this is a comment that's been made before in this meeting. This really doesn't just go back to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. The idea that the notion of the present moment as the reality, that where the reality of things and the truth of things inhere, the idea that that's false has a long history in physics, going back at least to Newtonian mechanics. It's not special to the worryings of quantum cosmologists. And this is because, as has been often pointed out, the notion of, quote, the present moment plays no role in either the statement of the principles of the laws of physics or their mathematical representation, going back to Newton and Galileo. Okay. And here's a quote that some of you will know, people, philosophers who know the history of this debate, but just for others who don't, this is Carnap, in his autobiography, reporting on a conversation with Einstein. And again, I won't read you the whole quote, but Einstein is troubled because the present moment has no place in physics. And Carnap argues with him. Let me just start with, I remarked that all that occurs objectively can be described in science. On the other hand, the temporal sequence of events is described in physics. And so the peculiarity of man's, you know, people's experience with respect to time, including the different attitudes towards past, present, and future, can be described and in principle explained by psychology. So that's pointing to a claim that I said has to be doable, that if the succession of present moments, if that experience is not because that's the way the world is organized, then you have to have some explanation of why we experience the world in that way, as a succession of present moments. And he says that psychology will explain it. And later, the quote continues, he points also to biology. And a branch of the argument that I don't have time to give here, but we can do in discussion, is that we are very unconvinced that any such arguments cash out. That is, that there actually is an argument from psychology or biology as to why we should experience time as a succession of present moments. But that's a branch, if you like, we can take up in discussion. What is the basic problem that Einstein worried about? It's a problem many people have worried about, and if you haven't worried about it, again, there's pub night tonight to start worrying about it. And this is that we experience the world as a succession of moments in time, but that fact has no place in the either the principles or the mathematical representation of physical systems. It disappears when we represent the world mathematically. How does this happen? We need to look in some detail at how this happens for the argument that we're going to make to get around this. Okay. Well, one place it happens, there, I'm going to give two passes to why this happens. One is the geometrization of time. This was Galileo's great discovery that I can record the motion of something on a graph in which there's a position axis for where it is and a time axis. And I, as I observe, I give a succession of points, and then I draw a curve, which is the motion, and then I've captured a mathematical representation of the motion of some system I'm studying, and the present moment has disappeared. Where now is not in the representation. The representation is just a mathematical object, which means that it's timeless. At least that's the common view of mathematical objects. It might be that one event on that succession of events is now, as we experience it, but it plays no role in the physical description. And that's what Einstein was worried about. Now, we want to make the claim, first of all, that in all the cases where this happens, this is unproblematic. In laboratory physics, which Galileo was concerned with, and Newton was mostly concerned with, and quantum mechanics is mostly concerned with, this is unproblematic because we are studying a subsystem of the universe. We observers are not part of it, so our experience of time or moments or becoming is not part of it. The time parameter is operationally the reading of a clock on the wall of the laboratory or something equivalent, which is not part of the system. So it makes perfect sense to make a series of observations of a system and represent them as a mathematical object or some kind of graph, in which the notion of passage becoming the present moment disappears. Okay, this is totally unproblematic. Our key wedge argument is that this is totally problematic as long as you're studying a subsystem of the universe. It is not necessarily unproblematic if you try to make a physical or mathematical description of the entire universe. And this is the wedge on which the bulk of the arguments that follow are turning. To discuss that in detail, that is the difference between describing a subsystem of the universe and attempting to make a mathematical or physical description of an entire universe, of the entire universe, let's look in some more detail. This is the second pass. This key to the how we represent physical systems, physical subsystems in mathematics, is the separation of the burden of explanation into two parts, the giving of the laws, which are common to many, many experimental realizations of that subsystem, and are in common and invariant over repeated measurements and many different measurements. And the initial conditions, which tell us what is distinguished about each particular experiment in time and in space. So this key is the separation into laws and initial conditions. There is a basic schema of law which goes, you know, was true of Newtonian mechanics, it's also true of general relativity, quantum mechanics, conventional quantum mechanics, many computer science systems, cellular automata, quantum circuits, etc. And let's see, we need the language of the schema. So this is a schema for explanation in which there is, first of all, a state space, S. It's assumed invariant under time. That is, we never think in physics about the possibility that the space of states is different at different times. And let me note that that's special Another branch of this argument, which I'll only have time, if any, to allude to later on, is that that's not what we do in biology or economics. The state space of the configuration changes in time in any actual real world attempt to make a mathematical description of biology or economics. But it is what we do in physics. In classical mechanics, it's the phase space. In quantum mechanics, the Hilbert space. So the first thing we do when we set up a schema of explanation is we give the space of possible states, which we believe are operationally realizable in any preparation or any measurement. The dynamics is specified by giving a rule that gives preferred curves on the space of states, such that if we're at a space x, there's a unique curve that passes through x called gamma, and we can evolve along gamma until we reach y, and then we predict that the system, the subsystem, is in the state y. So that's the separation. The separation between laws and initial conditions patches out between the clean separation between kinematics and dynamics, the clean separation between giving the state space and giving the dynamical law as motion on the state space. So we apply the schema to experiment. It's understood how to do it. Time is, in most cases, a parameter on the curve. And Julian has, and other people, say very interesting things about the nature of that parameter. Here, I'm just concerned with the simplest case in which the parameter represents the readings of a clock outside the system being modeled. And we evolve from initial states, which we prepare, to final states, which we measure. Again, the notion of the now has disappeared from the mathematical description, but as I argued, as long as it's a description of subsystems, it's perfectly appropriate that there's no representation of the notion of the now or the moment, because the observer is not part of the system. And indeed, what this is designed to do is get at, by the separation between laws and initial conditions, is to get a clean separation between those aspects of the system which are independent of when the experiment is done and those that depend on the initial conditions. Okay, so this is how time is eliminated in applications of the schema of explanation. There are several aspects of this in thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, et cetera. Notice a key thing, which is that causal relations between events which are played out in nature in time are represented in the schema by logical or mathematical relations between properties of a mathematical object. So causal relations which exist in nature in the history are represented by mathematical relations which are timeless, if you believe the usual thing that mathematical objects are timeless and their properties are timeless. And this is unproblematic in the context of subsystems. It's what Roberto calls the poison gift of mathematics to physics, because it's what makes possible the success of physics, but it also sets up the trap that we believe we have fallen into when we go to cosmology. But all applications of this unproblematic schema that have been successful apply either to subsystems of the universe, or those that are called, quote, cosmological, apply to only a few degrees of freedom, which are very rough coarse grainings of cosmological observations. Now, it's a common and true assertion that any fundamental theory must be cosmological. Why? Because in studying a subsystem, you truncate. You truncate in several different ways. You truncate because that's the style of physicists, to truncate and study simple models of degrees of freedom. And you truncate because you ignore the interactions between the degrees of freedom in the subsystem and the degrees of freedom outside the subsystem. So only a cosmological theory that does not, is explicitly about the whole universe and not about subsystems, could be truly fundamental. Everything else is an approximation, And therefore, that schema of explanation, which has been so successful, has to be as successful as it's been, understood as a schema for a certain kind of approximation, not as a schema for a fundamental theory. The key question we want to raise is, what is the schema for a fundamental theory, for a cosmological theory, and should it follow this Newtonian schema or not? And what follows is an argument that it should not and cannot. And this argument comes in several versions and several of different strengths. Let me start with just an anecdotal observation that attempts to apply the Newtonian schema, that mode of explanation, to cosmology result in confused and unanswerable questions. And a lot of research in cosmology revolves around confusions and failures to address those questions. These are questions like, what are the initial conditions of the universe, and how were they chosen? Because you believe in a schema that requires a separation to laws and initial conditions, which makes sense when you have many subsystems which represent the same kind of system, you are led by the poison gift, as Roberta would call it, to the trap of having to explain the initial conditions of the universe, which comes in only one version and which has no correspondence to anything we can prepare or measure. What was time before the Big Bang? How does an eternally true law of nature apply to a universe that only came into existence 13.8 billion years ago? What was the law doing before the universe came into existence, if it's eternally true? What is the status of points in the configuration space that are never realized in the history of the universe? That's unproblematic for a subsystem because we believe that every point in the configuration space is realizable by a preparation or a measurement. But it's not true in cosmology. Almost every point in the configuration space is not on the actual history of the universe. What is the status of lawful trajectories in the state space, possible histories, either evolutions of a quantum state or classical solutions to general relativity, which are not realized in nature? And related to these confusions, if somebody makes a discovery of a cosmological observation, and there are real examples of this, okay, that contradict some established or interesting law, for example, the possibility that there were observed non-Gaussianities which contradict the predictions of standard inflation, are these to be explained by changing the laws that held at those early times or changing the initial conditions? And I think there's an argument to be made that with one example, that is one past of our universe, one is not going to be able to decide between explanations by changing initial conditions and by changing laws. So we take this conundrum, that is the unanswerability and the confusion raised by questions like this, as evidence that we've stumbled into a fallacy. And the fallacy is taking the schema for explanation, which is applicable and powerful when applied to subsystems, and applying it to the whole universe. Because the elements of the schema, like the separation into laws and initial conditions, have no operational significance. Okay. And we call this fallacy the basic cosmological fallacy, just to hang something provocative, give it a provocative name. To apply to the whole universe a methodology that's only suitable for the study of small subsystems. Now, if we drop this schema and ask anew, how do we approach doing a science of cosmology? What could a law be in the context of cosmology? We have a hard question, and I'm not going to answer this question in this talk. I wish that we could. Okay. But notice that the arguments against the reality of the succession of present moments, which rest on the power of the Newtonian schema, are no longer applicable. One can simply sidestep them and say, yes, time disappears in Newtonian physics and applications of quantum mechanics and general relativity in the way described, but that's just applicable for subsystems. A fundamental theory has to be cosmological, and we don't believe that schema is not right for cosmology, and therefore the notion, the arguments based on that schema that time, that the reality of the succession of present moments is not true, disappears. So one has to ask, does it make sense to make in cosmology the separation of the burden of explanation into a part which relates to laws which are supposed to be timeless and a part which relates to initial conditions? Okay. Now, in the next segment of the talk, I'm going to drive the wedge in a little more provocatively and try to argue that not only should we logically free up the notion of law and its relation to time in cosmology, but there are good reasons to be skeptical about the proposition that the laws that we have so well confirmed in all its observations and experiments to date hold eternally. And there are several parts of that argument. One I've already alluded to. What does it mean to say that laws hold eternally if the universe we live in is only 14 billion years old? What that raises an incoherent question, several of them, like what was happening to the laws before. There are other aspects of these arguments. The singularity theorems in general relativity tell us either that the past is finite, so therefore it doesn't make any sense to talk about eternal laws, because the universe they apply to is finite, or some other laws other than the ones that we have confirmed experimentally govern the dynamics at very early stages in the universe. So either, well, let me, here, before I get to the either, let me up the ante a little bit. General relativity by itself, together with quantum field theory, cannot account for some basic features of the universe. For example, the isotropy of the cosmic microwave background, the relative isotropy, the fact that the sky everywhere appears to be within 1 part in 10 to the 5th at the same temperature. And that's the horizon problem. Either a quantum gravity effect, such as, for example, Neil or Roger discussed at this meeting, which is dominant and detectable only in the very, very early universe, bounces the universe so that there is a past before the Big Bang. But that's not confirmable by experiments now where we don't have such conditions. Or there is inflation driven by the potential energy of some unobserved field which is not experimentally accessible now. There's no one tries to create the inflaton at the LHC. Or the speed of light was much faster in the very early universe for some reason. Now, all of these are explanations which are on the table, and they're studied and discussed, and some of them have empirical consequences for the radiation from the Big Bang, but all of them ask us to believe that at a very early time a law dominates that we have no evidence for or no need for to explain present-day experiment. Now you can say, but it's still part of some simple eternal law, just different aspects of the law are dominating at different times, but you could also say, no, a different law is acting then, which acted then, and then it's different from the law that acts now. Now, the wedge that we're trying to drive is the first may be true, okay, but why are we asserting it? What are we protecting? What principle are we resting on when we assert that it's more rational or more likely that this one law, which has different phases, different manifestations, some of which can bounce a Big Bang singularity and others of which make the world we see, as opposed to just the law changed? Okay. Is it that, you know, in other words, do we prefer to believe in an unchanging law just because metaphysically we prefer to believe in it? Or do we have actually some scientific grounds for believing in an unchanging law? Here's another kind of argument that the laws change. We used to believe that part of the laws of physics were the statement that the geometry of space is three-dimensional Euclidean. Now in general relativity, we see that that law is the result of dynamical evolution. So the fact that was explained as a timeless aspect of law turns out just to be the result of evolution. The fact that the initial conditions were such and such early in the universe and an evolution law is holding. Are there other features of the eternal, of the laws that we used to think of as eternal laws of nature that are actually just the results of contingent situations or evolution? And the answer in the present day is most of them. For example, we used to believe that the fundamental laws of nature included the statement that energy is conserved, momentum is conserved, angular momentum is conserved. Now, in a contemporary point of view, we understand that those, by Noether's theorem, are consequences of the symmetries of the region of space-time in which the subsystem we are studying lives. And the fact that the region of space-time in which we live, in which we study the subsystems we study, has to some approximation those symmetries is a contingent fact which is the result of evolution from an earlier state. So those aspects of laws, and by now I have most of Newtonian mechanics, are just the result of dynamical evolution. There's a bunch more of these, and I'm going to skip a little bit the reasoning. What I want to assert is happening is that to some extent, Peirce's dictum that the only possible way of accounting for the laws of nature and of uniformity in general is to suppose the results of evolution is a project that's well advanced. That is, these different aspects of the laws that I've been discussing, the fact that space is Euclidean to a good approximation, the conservation laws that underlie Newtonian dynamics and quantum dynamics, are just the results of evolution as Peirce anticipated. Okay. Furthermore, the bit that I skipped is the bit in which properties like the masses of the elementary particles are not written into the fundamental theory, but are due to the fundamental theory being in a particular vacuum or phase, a mode of explanation that triumphs with spontaneous symmetry breaking in the electroweak theory and extends to the notion of the landscape in unified theories and string theories and so forth, that more and more of the properties of elementary particles are environmental, contingent, and the result of evolution. So this project, of course, is well advanced. Okay. And this was this aspect of the talk. Conclusions till this point. The arguments for the elimination of time are strong, but only in the context of physics of subsystems. And I reiterate why. These arguments fail when applied to the universe as a whole, because the separation of explanation into laws and initial conditions fails, that is, the operational conditions necessary to make use of that distinction between laws and initial conditions fail. Okay? Hence, the door is open to fully realizing Peirce's vision of a notion of law commingled with a notion of time in which time is real and laws evolve with respect to that real time. Okay. Now, before I get to the to come towards conclusions, I'm going to just allude to a couple of more arguments. And in the interest of time, I apologize, I can't go into them fully. This assertion, there is in fact good reason to consider the possibility that the laws or what's left of them after the 20th century evolved in time, refers to the consideration that I started with, the fact that of the different multiverse theories that attempt to offer explanation, only the one in which has genuine evolution of laws in time, that is the notion of cosmological natural selection, offers genuine explanation and genuine falsifiable predictions. So if you like, this is a talk that I gave two meetings ago at Perimeter. And I'm just going to bracket it here that there is in fact, an argument which is the kind of argument that Peirce anticipated, that the quality of the science you're doing and the possibility for explanation prediction gets stronger if you allow genuine evolution of laws in time. Okay. Sorry to skip through. This is a, you know, that this argument has many branches. Now, before closing, there are some obvious objections to the conclusion that I've been pointing towards. So let me raise those objections and deal with them. First, don't these contradict the quantum theory of gravity and cosmology, which is well developed, which says that time is emergent because the fundamental description is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation where there is no time? Well, what's the experience with the notion of time being emergent and space being emergent? Because as Neil pointed out, in contemporary approaches to quantum gravity, whether string theory through matrix models or the ADS-CFT formulation, or loop quantum gravity, spin foam models, causal dynamical triangulations, causal sets, quantum gravity, etc., the project is to start with a fundamental system without space, and sometimes without time, and get space-time to be emergent. And the record of successes and failures is that those programs which attempt to get the emergence of space-time so far don't get it. Those programs which assume there is a global time and tried, yes, to get the emergence of space do succeed, such as the work of Lowland, Amborn, and collaborators, causal dynamical triangulations, or the work of Marco Pulo and collaborators, quantum gravity, the work that Neil talked about yesterday here, matrix dynamics of strings, et cetera. Okay. So you can think that it's just harder to get the emergence of space-time without assuming there's a global notion of time. But this is where we are technically. And since it piles up this way, maybe we should take it seriously. Doesn't this suggest that the relativity of simultaneity is not going to be fundamentally true if successful theories of quantum gravity have global times? And I think we have to face this, and the answer is yes. One reason is that if space is emergent, then locality is emergent, then there is a phase of your system in which there is no notion of locality, and all the degrees of freedom are talking to each other. And in such a situation, there has to be a global time so that the degrees of freedom can sort out who talks to who. This is an argument that several people from those programs, Fotini, Renata, and some other people have made, that if there can be a possibility of a phase where space is not emergent, there has to be a global time. Okay, might there be a hidden absolute simultaneity? Why not? The second objection goes to the heart of this. There's a standard argument that all the philosophers in the room will know, and the physicists can probably invent, that if you believe in the relativity of simultaneity in either special or general relativity, and you assert the reality of properties being tied to a particular present moment or simultaneity, you can argue from the relativity of simultaneity to the equal reality of the whole of space-time and therefore to the block universe. And again, applied to cosmology, I think one has to face this squarely and say that there is a number of pieces of evidence that the relativity of simultaneity is an important property when studying subsystems, but is not going to be fundamental. And some of those arguments, one was given by Julian in his talk yesterday. One I've just alluded to. Others have been alluded to in this meeting. For example, there is, after all, a preferred simultaneity in cosmology. Do you really believe that in the equivalence of that preferred simultaneity with the simultaneity that you would get by boosting so much that the Hubble scale is a millionth of a Planck scale? Do you really believe that that's a principle of nature? I'm going to skip the argument from biology in the interest of time. And summarize here. But again, if people want the argument from biology, let me give it half a minute, because it's an important piece of this. The argument from biology comes from Stuart Kaufman, who's a theoretical biologist, who makes in recent books, especially his last book, a strong case that any successful mode of explanation biology has to incorporate the possibility of novelty. That is, that it's impossible to design an algorithm or a methodology that could predict what proteins are going to be dominant in the biosphere in a billion years or 10 billion years. And therefore, that the notion that you can just work within the configuration space of all the possible molecules, biological molecules, and all the possible concentrations in the biosphere is hopeless. There's no algorithm to work it out. There's no methodology. And one, therefore, has to believe in the possibility that the space of properties and the set of properties that are relevant for biological explanation or explanation in natural selection change as the system evolves and discovers what properties give fitness in particular cases and what properties don't give fitness in particular cases. That's half of Kaufman's argument. The other half of Kaufman's argument is that if we live in a universe where explanation requires novel properties to be invented as systems evolve, then that cannot live with a notion, even a weak notion of reductionism, to laws of physics that live in a configuration space that is completely timeless. And I can, if people want, I can flesh that argument out, but that's another branch of the arguments here. Okay. So our key points. Again, I'm reiterating, until recently, all successes of science were the result of studies of models of small subsystems. Okay. The theory of a whole universe, if we ever have such a thing, must be structurally different from theories of subsystems, and must be structurally different, we are arguing, in that the separation of laws and initial conditions in theories of subsystems cannot apply in the theory of the universe. So the key difference between subsystems, descriptions of subsystems, and descriptions of a whole universe have to do with the notion of law and the related notion of time. In particular, time has to disappear in theories of subsystems, but the door is open, and indeed the project is already somewhat advanced, to the notion that time is non-emergent and fundamental in cosmology, and laws, everything up to including laws, are emergent. So we consider two hypotheses. The hypothesis that the laws that apply on a cosmological scale may evolve in time, and the counter older hypothesis that the universe is governed by timeless laws according to the Newtonian schema or something like that. The second, we argue, and this is really just a development of Peirce's arguments, that the second leaves us in a position of irrationality. It leaves us unable to explain why these laws rather than other laws. It leaves us unable to explain why these initial conditions rather than other initial conditions. And therefore, we have to, if we want to believe in the timelessness of cosmological laws, and cosmological laws being like local laws, we have to accept a huge failure of explanation, a huge failure to realize the ambitions of Leibniz, for example, of the principle of sufficient reason, that everything observable be explicable. The other possibility is to accept Peirce and consider the idea that laws evolve and have the possibility of genuine explanation about questions like why these laws and why this solution to the laws. Okay. This, we admit, is puzzling. There, and I'm sure if people raise questions in discussion, there are ways in which this is a puzzling project. But our claim is that it's not an irrational project, and that, therefore, it's better than the older project. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Hi. I think there's a precisely parallel argument that you might think of making with regard to causal relations, because those have a disputed status in philosophy, because people say, well, look, you know, in physics, what you really have is correlations. Correlations aren't the same thing as causal relations. You can't reduce causal relations to correlations. And in fact, what you need is to think to get causal relations from correlations is to be able to have a notion of what's called an intervention, which is effectively an action on a system from outside. You need to be able to treat some variables as free variables. There are no free variables in the universe as a whole. So really, you need the special status of causal relations. It seems, I mean, of interventions, it seems very natural to think that that notion, the notion of an intervention, really is one that arises when, you know, you are not treating yourself as part of the system you're modeling, but thinking of your own actions as, in some sense, independent. So you think of scientific models in general as effectively tools for interacting with an open subsystem.
So, I mean, all I can say is thank you. And the getting into the difficulties of the philosophical notions of causation is something which Roberto has some writing about and which I have ahead of me. So I appreciate that as a guidance. I have not thought in that direction.
Lee, thanks for a fascinating talk. I wanted to suggest that what you're trying to do might be clarified a bit by drawing a distinction between two kinds of issues about time, which seem to me to be largely orthogonal to one another. One is the issue as to whether time, to the extent that it's real, is fundamental or emergent. The other is the issue as to whether time needs to be understood in terms of anything like an objective flow or an objective present. To see that those issues are orthogonal, you just have to see that two people who both take the block view can perfectly well argue about whether time, to the extent that there is time, is a fundamental property or an emergent property or characteristic of the universe. And so a lot of the kinds of arguments that you've offered us are perfectly good arguments to be offered by someone who believes in a block view of time, and is arguing with an opponent who also believes in the block view of time. But what they're disagreeing about is just how fundamental it is. And then the other issue is whether in order to have a view in which there's real time, we need to have something like a real present or a real flow of time. Now, what you've done, in effect, is to say that when we move to the cosmological situation, we move away from one reason for taking a stand on the no objective flow of time side of that question, namely the one associated with the fact that we're no longer considering subsystems. But there are lots of other reasons for taking a stand on that side. I mean, reasons which really have nothing to do with physics, just philosophical reasons about the incoherence of the notion of an objective present or the notion of flow, or the analogies, very good analogies in my view, between the notion of the present or the now and notions like here, cases in which it's clear that although from a perspective it can look as if there's something special about this place, we soon learn that that's a distinction we draw from a perspective. And similarly, in the case of the distinction we draw between ourselves and others, from the naive perspective it looks like there's an objective distinction there, but one of the things we learn is that there isn't. So there are those sorts of philosophical reasons, which, as I said, have nothing to do with physics, but thinking that there's something deeply wrong with the idea that the present or flow is part of the structure of reality. But those reasons are largely orthogonal to what you're really interested in here, which is the status of time in cosmology.
Okay, let me address, thank you for that. Let me address the first part of that because I have something to say for it. And I actually have some slides prepared about this, but I'll try to be brief. If I believe in the block universe, okay, I'm one step away from what Max Tegmark calls his mathematical universe hypothesis. The mathematical universe hypothesis says there is in some formal axiomatic system some mathematical object, okay, every property of which is isomorphic to a property of the history of the block universe, and vice versa, so that everything which is a true property of the block universe is a true theorem about a mathematical object in a formal axiomatic system. Okay. Now, I agree that's more than the block universe, but many people who believe the block universe go on to assert that mathematical universe hypothesis. That is, that the universe has a precise double, isomorphic double, is a mathematical object. Okay. However, okay, and here's where the issues are linked, okay, a property that, that I believe is true of the actual universe where we live is not represented in any mathematical object, and that's the present moment, the fact that everything that I observe, everything that I experience, is experienced within a moment. Okay. And so there is, to my mind, because of that, a relationship between, and I understand what you said, and it's possible to deny the implication from the block universe to the mathematical universe hypothesis, but it's a road very commonly taken, and it's the road that leads to the claim that, you know, our experience of time is an illusion that is corresponds to nothing which is a true property of the block universe, which could be a property of the mathematical object that's isomorphic to the block universe. Against this, some people say, well, you know, there's the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in physics, so the mathematical universe hypothesis by extension of the successive mathematics must be true, to which we reply, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in physics may only succeed to the extent that we restrict the description of physics to subsystems, and therefore the applicability of mathematics to physics may be reasonable because it's limited. That is, there are true facts and real, you know, things about the actual universe that are not representable by mathematical systems, because mathematical properties of formal axiomatic systems are games that we play to define sets of things that are true regardless of what time and in what context they're discussed.
So, shall I? Okay, so I had a naive question. So when you're saying laws must evolve, it seems to beg the question, well, how do they evolve? And that seems to require another sort of meta law, which prescribes how these laws are working. So, or maybe I should say not meta, but a better law. And it seems like the examples you gave sort of fit into that. Like, well, we don't know, say the coupling constants evolve. Well, then you have a better theory in which that tells you how they evolve. Or, well, angular momentum's not preserved. Well, you have a better theory which tells you why that is and how it changes. So
yes.
That's one thing. And then a related question is, yeah, so that's number one. And then number two is, I'm no expert, but there's a lot of smart people have thought, well, this question of having no physical laws, does that statement really make any sense? So that's another related.
Right. So of course, we anticipated this question. This is one of the puzzling aspects. Mustn't there be a meta law to govern the evolution of law? Okay. And then aren't we back to the same irrationality that Peirce worried about? And possible responses, okay, and we don't have a single response to this, are yes, but the meta law must be a new form of a law, which does not fit into the Newtonian scheme and does not allow a choice of initial conditions. Okay? Yes, but the new meta law must be of a form whose configuration space is constructed only as the universe evolves, as in Kaufman's, would be an application of Kaufman's methodology in theoretical biology and economics to cosmology, something called the adjacent possible, that is, you allow the possibility that it's possible to compute on some computer that fits into the universe, you know, a few possible steps of evolution and construct a configuration space as you go along, but you can't construct a configuration space in advance. Yes, but the meta law is a trivial law. Just like there is universal computation, there might be universal meta law, so that anything that satisfied the conditions of being a meta law would be equivalent to anything else that satisfied the conditions of being a meta law. So the statement of, so you would not get caught in why this, you know, the danger of meta laws, okay, which is happening for real, okay, is somebody says, I have my meta law and you have your meta law, and now you have to remember we're still scientists, so how are we going to decide which meta law we believe in when there can't, by definition, be an empirical choice between them because they both allow the laws that we observe as possibilities. And the last point, which is the provocative point of Roberto Unger that I started with, is maybe just no. Maybe explanation on a cosmological scale reduces to recovery of a narration from evidence. Okay. Now, I don't know which of those is right, but I think that we have to be raising the question. And at least the last possibility, which I don't like, I think has to be on the table just to provoke us, because that's where we will be if we will either be there or with why this meta law rather than some other meta law, okay, unless we can come up with something better.
It seems to me that your main argument, I mean, is focused on a good point, that in physics, time is geometrized.
In physics,
time is geometrized.
Yes.
So we lose a lot of the properties that we usually, I mean, at least in our mind, we ascribe to time. And if you want to go against it, one of the problems is that mathematics would not be available to you. So maybe you can overcome the poison, and it might be good. But then the question is whether you would be able, I mean, to construct something that will be as detailed and interesting as the physics of subsystem. And the other problem would be to connect the physics of subsystem, according to you, to this theory that would be very different. So it seems to me that if you want to be coherent, maybe you have to be more radical that you are willing, and just to give up even the physics of subsystem and to go to some different way of thinking that will connect, I mean, the, you know, thinking about cosmology and subsystems.
Yeah, so very good, and your first point is very well taken. And so in discussions about this, okay, some mathematicians, for example, Lou Kaufman and Jaron Lanier, have expressed the view that there could be a form of mathematics which was somehow essentially time-bound or time-drenched, not in the sense that there's some parameter, okay, but in the sense that different axioms become true, and, you know, there's a logic that goes from one axiom to its negation, and a logic that goes from that to the negation of the negation, or something like that. So that there might be a form of mathematics in which the succession of moments played a role, and this is not the psychological time of the intuitionist, but in some fundamental structural way, the succession of moments was represented in how the mathematics was structured. I don't know any, so I'm deeply confused about that, so I just note that these two very smart people, Jaron Lanier and Lou Kaufman and some others, have strongly advanced that project, or proposed that project as a response to this. Again, I think it's something that should be on the table.
A couple of things. One is that it seems that some things like the block universe are, in a sense, a result of metaphor. I think about some of our modern graphics programs, medical doctors who want to look at you, and they slide a little pointer of their computer screen, and what they get is a sequence of cross-sections of the body. And for them, the Z, or sometimes the X, is a sequence of instances.
Mm-hmm.
And there the metaphor is time as a metaphor for the spatial thing. In the block universe, you're sort of going the other direction, taking space as a metaphor for time. But these are just metaphors. They're not taking them to be reality is almost always a mistake of metaphors. Second thing is
I agree, by the way. I agree. So,
in the emergence and so forth, the question is, as you're approaching here, is emergence out of what? Or evolution from what? And I think all of these explanations you have real problems. In some cases, it throws everything onto initial conditions. That's the sort of direction that string theory is going now, that there exists no laws, that all there is initial conditions. Or your first one is like Arlo and Hawking, wave function for the universe, where there is no initial condition. There's only this meta principle. So I think, I mean, Hoffman's, you know, the development of configuration space, you can always expand your configuration space to include those things which are not there now. You know, the concept of kingship was a new discovery in human history at a certain point of political thought. And you could say, well, the configuration space of political thought suddenly expanded to include the concept of a king. Or you could say that before that time, there were these three possibilities, king and no king, and before that time, you just happened to be in the state of no king, and at a certain point in time, you became, went into the state of king. So you can sort of recast this developing configuration space into an invariant configuration space theory.
Okay, so I think I agree with everything you said except the last point. So let me just address the last point. And by the way, I'm glad we agree about the other things. The argument, and again, you know, let me refer to Stu's book, Investigations, which is also an attempt by a scientist to make a philosophical argument for the details of the argument. But the claim that he makes is that there are so many possibilities for things like kings, as king, being a king is a way, you know, to be, to have a lot of fitness, and there's so many possibilities for ways to have a lot of fitness that you can, in retrospect, explain in biology by saying, yes, here's a new way of having fitness, and it was achieved, and it stays around because it accords fitness. But the claim is that the number of possibilities for things that could confer fitness combinatorially explodes in such a way that no algorithm that could be computed on a computer that could fit into the biosphere or the universe or what have you could carry out that program. And there are many examples. There are situations called exaptation where some particular property of an organism confers fitness for some reason. Say, you know, flappy skin from the front limbs of certain squirrels was fit because it conveyed warmth or was sexy or something like that. And then in a different environment, it conveyed fitness because you could escape predators by jumping off of trees and gliding. And the claim is that there's so many examples like exaptation that you cannot make the configuration space. That is, let me flesh out a little bit of the argument. Why is fitness important? Because you cannot do a computation in biology without a notion of fitness, and therefore you have to identify as functions of whatever the properties of the molecular constitution of an organism that that imbue you with fitness. And then the claim is one cannot specify all the ways of doing that in advance. Let me note, by the way, that there's a school of thought in economics and political theory that Unger exemplifies that makes the same argument as the theoretical biologists. And it's interesting that they're unaware of each other. So that's just one of these strange things about intellectual history. You can find analogies between, or isomorphisms, or, you know, strong parallels between the arguments made in these two very different domains for this conclusion.
Okay, we have time for one more question. The rest has to go for lunch discussions.
Following on your comments about mathematics, do you think that perhaps the appearance of any evolution of the so-called laws could be due just to the discreteness of the fundamental discreteness of the universe? That is, back near some seminal event like the Big Bang, things were less complex, and the properties of the first million integers, for example, are somewhat subtly different than the properties of all the integers.
Well, so there is, I don't know in general, but there is a related argument that Wolfram makes that there are cellular automata for which a simple rule will predict the far future evolution. And that's many different cellular, so cellular automata are a schema for deterministic discrete evolution. And there also are cellular automata for which there is no smaller algorithm that can predict the future state of the cellular automata besides running the cellular automata. So if you believe that nature is a cellular automata and you believe it's one of those, then any attempt at having, quote, a law that is an approximate description that you can write on a piece of paper to predict the future of the universe is going to be necessarily approximate. And over ranges of space and time in the future of evolution of the cellular automata, there may be some local laws which come into play and then disappear. But it's a theorem in the subject of cellular automata that for these kinds of cellular automata, there's no global simplification. And that's another aspect of this argument. Okay, well, I think that was the last question. I think before we go to lunch and then the panel discussion, I think we should thank the organizers. This has been a fantastic meeting. Lucy looks like he wants to stand up. Were you going to say something? Okay.
So, first of all, don't forget to stick your questions. So, here's mine. Just a few things. So, first of all, you can watch the seminars in this from this conference on HRSA, and I'll give you the URL for that. Go to HRSA.org is the main page. If you want to go to the page for this website, it's C08 for the year and 023 for the conference. Secondly, there's a pub night tonight. This happens every week on a Thursday at Perimeter, where pub food is served. It's quite cheap. It's about $5 for a pub meal and also a beer. Who's going to be around for that? Who will be around for that?
What time is it?
It starts, I think, at 5:30 onwards, yeah, until about 8.
Where is it?
Bistro upstairs. So I'm seeing about 15 hands. Okay, thanks.
Okay, and then I thought since a lot of people would be leaving before the afternoon sessions, the discussion sessions, I thought I'd just go through and thank the various people
who've been involved indirectly or directly in this conference. So first of all, the whole PIAF collaboration got started, was initially something that got started by Howard Burton. So he was played a big role in making this happen. Then Michael Duchesne here has played a big role in helping to formulate the way the PIAF collaboration has worked, in structuring it and talking to the various parties, as well as other people in the PIAF project. Then on the advisory committee for this conference, we had people who were also involved in the PIAF collaboration, Hugh Price, Gerald Milburn, Steve Bartlett, and Howard Wiseman. The administration staff, the people who helped make this conference possible, were Kate Gillespie, before she went to another job, and Dawn Bombay, and Liam Kane has helped also. Then the Bistro staff have been very good in providing food. So Dan Lynch is the manager, Carla is the chef, and various other people there. Then the organizers of this conference, in addition to myself, were Ward Stroiber, who I can't see where he is, but he may not be in the room. So Ward Stroiber was, you maybe didn't see him, but he played a very big role in organizing this conference. Chris Fuchs, you've seen, and Guido Bacigalupi, who couldn't make it, but helped a lot in organizing the conference. So thank you. And one more very important group I forgot to mention, maybe the most important group, were the speakers, who gave absolutely tremendous talks. So thank you very much.